Okay, hello everybody. So this is a conversation with the journalist Norman Ohler. He is best known for writing a book called Blitzed, which came out in 2015. Blitzed is an amazing chronicle of drug use in the Third Reich. It covers the strategic military use of methamphetamine by the Nazis, as well as by Hitler himself. And at this point, it is now sort of somewhat common knowledge. People talk about this as an interesting factoid about World War II. Did you know the Nazis were on methamphetamine? Did you know the Nazis had methamphetamine swastika emblazoned chocolate? Actually, there seems to be a little bit of debate about that one. And people love the idea because it makes a sort of intuitive sense. We all know that Nazis are bad, and we all know that methamphetamine promotes bad behavior. So what happens when you put two and two together? And I certainly understand the logic, but I think it's instances like this where it's superficially and intuitively, perhaps because of certain cultural biases, makes sense that you have to be most careful to approach ideas with skepticism. So much of how we conceptualize drugs like methamphetamine is a product of the cultural matrix in which we currently reside. At the time of its discovery, it represented a way of increasing the potency of a traditional medicine in Japan, ephedra. And for the first decades of its use, it was considered largely innocuous. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the idea of a substance that gives you more energy and improves your mood, allows you to resist the need for sleep or food. And if you look at historical descriptions of methamphetamine, and even more specifically of the brand of methamphetamine used by the Nazis, pervitin, what you find is that it sounds entirely innocent. If you substituted the word pervitin with cordyceps or rhodiola, nobody would bat an eye. There's nothing intrinsically sinister about what is being described. And just to give you an example, there is a legendary Austrian mountaineer named Hermann Buhl, and he is most famous for having accomplished the first ascent of Nanga Parbat in 1953, but he wrote a couple of books. One is called Lonely Challenge, the other is called Nanga Parbat Pilgrimage, where he describes his use of pervitin, and it sounds completely wonderful. I mean, I'll just read a passage from one of these books. To cheer me up, they gave me two little white tablets called pervitin. They wanted to carry me down the glacier, but I felt fit enough to go on my own. The only thing that hurt was my right shoulder. Had I broken my collarbone or damaged a shoulder blade? The tablets acted marvelously, and I soon felt as fit as if nothing had happened. I even skied away from the others. I raced up the slope to the hut as if it were a real competition, but then I had to go straight to bed. They poured a quart of brandy and then another into me, and then I went to sleep. Was it the pervitin that gave me my strength back and revitalized my body so quickly? That was the first time I had heard of the miraculous drug and felt its marvelous effects. That's touching. That's very nice. Later, he's in danger of dying on a mountain and is saved by methamphetamine. Again, these are not the sorts of stories you typically hear about methamphetamine, but this is the way it was being described. This was not a controversial description, right? When I proposed making an episode called A Positive Methamphetamine Story, it was kind of like, you know, a record screech, like, what? That's crazy. But here, not only is it not crazy, this is a completely normal description of methamphetamine saving somebody's life mountaineering. Again, here's another passage from this book. There were no means of avoiding the snow structures, many feet high, however much I tried to skirt them. I was staggering like a drunkard, falling, crawling, standing, walking, falling again. Then I remembered the pervitine again. It was the only chance. Its brief renewal of my strength might last long enough for me to get down to the tent. That is, if I hadn't already used the last reserve of strength left in me. For I felt absolutely finished. Blood and spittle were coming out of my mouth, which was completely gummed up, and I had to force the three tablets down as if wooden wedges. I began counting the yards as the rim of snow drew nearer. Okay, and then a little later he says, then at last I knew I was safe. The knowledge that I was near my teammates gave me newborn confidence. My old tracks were still in good condition, and I traversed slowly along them to the ridge. For the moment, I felt fresher again, either because of the pervitine or because of the blessed feeling of relief. Breathing became easier too, but I still had to use extreme care. The crampon came loose again, and I took it off in a rage and threw it out over the south face without further ado. I made relatively rapid pace down the exposed ridge, moving forward through crust past the whipped cream roll until, at 7 p.m., 41 hours after leaving the spot, I approached the tent. So that's nice. And if you look through 20th century military history, you find that the use of methamphetamine by the Nazis is not really extraordinary, right? Amphetamine was being used by other countries. Amphetamine was used extensively by the United States in Vietnam. Modafinil is used by the military to this day, as well as amphetamine. And so with everyone everywhere using these stimulants, it becomes a complicated question in terms of accurately assessing what kind of role they play, if any at all. Many college students take amphetamine during exams and do not typically engage in acts of genocide. So clearly this is not something that necessarily results from the consumption of amphetamine-type stimulants. But these associations have real political value, right? They are, without question, exploited in various ways, whether it's discussions of ISIS or various other jihadist groups using Captagon, which is a sort of amphetamine pro-drug, or it's actually not. If you look at some of the analytical literature, Captagon, which is supposed to be a drug called phenethylamine, is typically just amphetamine mixed with caffeine. It's supposed to be this amphetamine linked to theophylline with a 2-carbon linker, but why would anyone go to the trouble of making something like that in a clandestine lab, especially because theophylline is barely even active? So when you actually look at the analysis of illicit tablets, it's typically just amphetamine or methamphetamine mixed with caffeine or occasionally theophylline. But most of what I've seen shows that Captagon does not contain phenethylamine, despite what you may have read. And now you're seeing this with Captagon and Hamas and even fentanyl and Hamas, and you start to realize how the associations with these drugs are so easily weaponized. I mean, the most obvious example would be the characterization of GHB as a date rape drug, as if there's something about the molecular structure of that particular substance that promotes sexual assault. And this is something that I've been thinking about a lot more. Like I was looking at an old interview that I did, and I was kind of nonchalantly saying, yeah, I think psychedelics, you know, I think they make people more ecologically aware, and I think they make people a bit nicer. But what I've come to realize is that as innocuous as a statement like that might sound, right, as innocuous as saying that Nazis are evil, there is a price to be paid for any kind of deterministic argument, which is it opens the door for deterministic counterarguments. Determinism begets more determinism. And a more mature way of conceptualizing these substances is to recognize that while they do impart an effect, obviously, that effect is largely mediated by the cultural, historical context in which they are consumed. This conversation with Norman Ohler was conducted a couple of months ago in the Czech Republic. And since our discussion, Norman was kind enough to record a sort of audiobook chapter of his newest book for listeners on the Patreon so they can hear his book. I don't think it's been published in English quite yet, but it's going to come out soon. It's been published in German, if there are any German speakers. And if you have the opportunity to read it, I'd love to hear in the comments section what you think of it. I've heard really great things about it. It's about him studying the history of LSD and giving LSD to his mother who has Alzheimer's disease. And I think Norman Ohler is a brilliant historian. I think he's doing research that is often presented as if it's somehow obscure or strange when it's really clearly essential for understanding huge aspects of our culture, whether it's medical history or military history. Some of these things that he was telling me about Sandoz, I'd never heard before. The idea that they had a specific room for intoxicated employees called a Rausch room is very amazing. Or that Albert Hofmann was doing self-experiments with LSD while undergoing military training to find the best microdose of LSD for a sort of performance enhancement. Also something I'd never heard before. So this conversation covers a lot of interesting historical and philosophical things ranging from Nazi psychedelic experiments to MKUltra to how we culturally conceptualize psychoactive drugs. This was also the subject of a lecture I actually gave earlier today at Columbia University for a class that Carl Hart was teaching, which I recorded and could release on the Patreon as well. But I think before I do that, I've got the Q&A. There's Matt Baggett. There's actually a lot of really... Oh, and also an interview with one of the Manson family members. I'm just going to leave it at that, but that's also really good. So there's a lot of amazing stuff coming out this month. Thank you all for your patience, and I hope you enjoy this talk with the great Norman Ohler. Oh, and if you want to hear that excerpt from his new book that he recorded for you all, it's attached to this post. For as long as it has existed, the market for street drugs, supplements, and even pharmaceutical products has been marked by uncertainty regarding chemical identity and purity. Colorimetric reagents and repurposed urine test strips offer some protection, but they are no substitute for analytical techniques like mass spectrometry. In the United States, drug testing is fraught with bureaucratic hurdles, but in Spain, scientists are free to perform chemical analysis without legal interference. I've recently partnered with a Barcelona-based laboratory called Kykeon Analytics, who offer NMR, FTIR, and LC-MS/MS for any plants or chemicals one might wish to analyze. I submitted a few samples and was impressed by their ability to detect a psilocin ester in a gummy product, an unusual modafinil analog with precise structural assignments, and a diphenhydramine analog. Samples can be sent anonymously from anywhere in the world, and the pricing is extraordinary for the service they provide. Additionally, results are made publicly available for harm reduction and research purposes. To learn more, go to KykeonAnalytics.com. I think probably a lot of people listening to this will be aware of Blitzed. But for people that aren't aware of the research that you did for Blitzed, could you tell me a little bit about what inspired you to write that and what you found?
So we're basically rolling already?
We're rolling.
Okay. I was searching for a new topic for a novel in 2010 when a friend of mine stood very impressively in front of me in my writing tower in Berlin, and he said, "You have to write about the Nazis and all the drugs that they took." And I looked at him and I said, "They didn't take any drugs," because I still believed my grandfather, who taught me when I was like in, when I was like 10 years old in West Germany in like in 1980, that the Nazis, maybe they exaggerated it with the Jews, but basically they were a very disciplined government and everything was in order in Germany. I mean, obviously he was still a Nazi. And I didn't believe him, but still that piece of Nazi propaganda that they installed through the mass media, that they were like bringing order to the German people, that still stuck not only with me, but with most of the German public. So when Alex, my friend, the DJ who stood impressively in front of me in my writing tower said that the Nazis took a lot of drugs. I thought he's full of drugs. So he's just, you know, hallucinating or something. But then he said, no. A friend of mine, he's an antique dealer. He just bought like an old East Berlin apartment, like everything that's inside the apartment. And he bought also an old medicine chest. And in this medicine chest was a medication called Pavitin. And we read on the package that the only ingredient is methamphetamine. Do you know what that means? And I said, yeah, I don't know what methamphetamine. So he said, yeah, we took it. We took these pills. There were like a couple of hundred pills left. So quite an amount, but they took them all over the course of like 2 weeks. And then Alex said when he first took it, and he said, when I took the first Pavitin, it was like, yeah, okay, I can feel something's coming on. He's a resident DJ of Club of Visionaries in Berlin, so he's used to, like, he can evaluate drugs, basically. And then I took another one, and then it was stronger. And then I took a third pill of Pavitin, or tablet, rather. And then I felt, he said, and he used the German word Schub. I felt Schub. And Schub, and then he pointed outside, because there's a river outside, and kind of big ships go by. And he said, well, Schub is what a big ship experiences when all the engines are switched on and then the whole thing moves forward. So that's how he felt, because he's a big man. So with three Pavitin tablets, he felt this shoop, like he felt really a strong power within him that would move him forward. And when he told me this, I kind of started researching a little bit online, like Nazis and drugs. And there were like a few reports that there was some methamphetamine somewhere. And there was a scientific paper by a southern German medicinal historian. And he focused on methamphetamine and the German army. And he wrote a paper, 2 or 3 pages long, and he had the thesis that the Blitzkrieg was not only methamphetamine supported, but actually methamphetamine induced. So basically he said without methamphetamine, there would have been no Blitzkrieg. But he was like he was writing this in some journal and no one really read it, but I'd found it online, and then I met him. And then he said, well, you have to go to the military archive of Germany, which is housed in Freiburg in the south of Germany, which is like the archives is like as big as a town, you know, because it's the archives of all the German armies and all their lost wars and everything, because Germany documents everything. So there's a huge amount of information on the German army. And he had told me where to look for the methamphetamine abuse of the Wehrmacht. And it was actually all there. And there was a lot more there than he had examined in his smallish paper. And that's kind of how I found out that there's actually quite a big story that no one had ever looked at. Like, how did the Wehrmacht abuse synthetic stimulants in order to gain military advantage, and that it actually worked? So that was a big story that I found.
These days, alternative cannabinoids or alt-noids have become increasingly popular. You may have heard about THCP or THCV, but have you heard of THCB? B. The butyl, over 86% pure THCB isolate. That's impressive. This was just a year or two ago, a trace oddity that people only speculated about. Now we're living in the future. You can get THCB on the internet. If you're listening to this right now, you can just order THCB. What a time to be alive. Can you imagine? You can just order the butyl THC, THCB, from CannaClear.com. Use the promo code Hamilton. You gotta cherish these moments while they last, because one day you're gonna wake up and the government is going to have decided to protect you from THCB. They're going to step in to save you from THCB.
Yeah, I find it so fascinating on several levels. I mean, one is just the historical reality that this occurred that is typically not appreciated. By any chance, have you seen this book by Ron Rosenbaum, Explaining Hitler? Do you know this book?
No, I have not.
Oh, I think you really like it. Yeah, it's an amazing book. And the name is not what it sounds like.
And is it new?
It's from the 90s. It came out in the mid-90s.
I should have probably read it from my book.
But it's not what it sounds like. It's not a book explaining Hitler. It's a book about people's attempts to explain Hitler. So he travels around the world and interviews different Hitler explainers about their Hitler explanations. And so it's like a sort of meta analysis of human explanation for evil. And so there's a person who's become obsessed with this idea that the Jewish physician that treated Hitler's mother's breast cancer used iodoform soaked bandages that caused some kind of skin ulceration that caused her pain, and the pain that the Jewish doctor may have inadvertently inflicted upon Hitler's mother could have been some kind of rational seat of his anti-Semitism. Or maybe there's people that are obsessed with the possibility that Hitler only had one testicle, and maybe it's the monorchid madness of his testicular abnormality that made him who he was. And the whole premise of this book explaining Hitler is, you know, the director Claude Lanzmann, who made Shoah. So he had this philosophy that the very act of explaining Hitler and the Holocaust was, in his words, an obscenity. That in the act of explanation, you trivialize and minimize the horror. And so you shouldn't even attempt to explain it. And this massive book explaining Hitler is kind of this maximalist response to, like Claude Lanzmann says, it's an obscenity to ask why. We'll all spend 1,000 pages asking why, only to come to the same point of saying that any explanation is ridiculous, that there is no explanation. But I think one issue I have with the amphetamine isn't that it isn't true. Obviously, it is true. But my concern is that people will say amphetamine, therefore the Nazis, therefore Hitler, therefore the Holocaust. How do you draw the line? Because people are using amphetamine today. People used amphetamine around the world. So what makes it different that the Nazis used amphetamine?
Well, first of all, I want to say something to this topic of explaining. And I think Don DeLillo also makes kind of fun of it in Mao too, which is said in the like the Department of Hitler Studies in some American university.
Oh, in White Noise.
Yeah, it's in White Noise.
Yeah.
And I actually did not try to explain anything in a way. And I also didn't. Well, I mean, I described like Hitler being totally fucked up on opioids on like October 22nd, 1943, because you have records for that day. So, you know, he was fucked up, you know, what opioids he was shooting and what he said and what decisions he took. So I found it interesting to describe these scenes because you could really get close to this moment and even kind of try to understand what he was on. So it's not really, it doesn't explain anything. I think the book doesn't explain anything. It just gives a sharper, sharper or more colorful or more interesting kind of narrative. But it doesn't change the narrative. It's totally the same narrative. The Nazis are the Nazis and they lost the war because Hitler was, it's not a different story. But by talking about the methamphetamine, not just amphetamine, methamphetamine, I think actually that you can describe things more accurate. For example, the so-called, in German, Westfeldzug, the attack on the West, on Luxembourg, Belgium, Holland, and France. You can actually look at the genesis of the strategy for this campaign, the Western campaign. This is the classical Blitz campaign, is the Western campaign. How was the German army able to beat the French and the British army together? Because they had more manpower, they were better equipped, like they had better tanks. And like the old school military wisdom said, you need to be three times superior to the force that you're trying to invade. Because if you invade, you have to be much stronger to actually have a successful invasion. And the Germans were weaker. But the idea was to speed within 3 days and three nights through the mountains in the middle, because the French and the British were in the north of Belgium, awaiting the attack there, and they were in the south at the Maginot Line. They never thought that Germans could go through the Ardennes mountain range. And going through the Ardennes mountain range was only possible because the German army did not sleep at night, because usually an army sleeps at night. It kind of makes camp. But that would have taken too long. The news would have spread to the Allied defenders that the Germans are attacking, and they could have come from the north and the south and kind of crushed them in the middle. So they had to be quicker. Then they would be able to come down from above and up from below. So they could not sleep, and it's quite impossible for a whole army. It never happened before that they were able to fight for 3 days and three nights without stopping. This is not possible without stimulants. Well, it's never been, you know, it was never possible. But you can see that the German army, when this strategy is developed, Hitler is, like, the strategy is developed by three tank generals. They were kind of the crazy tank generals, and they have a breakfast meeting with Hitler on February 17th, and they tell him, we're going to go through the Ardennes Mountains. That's the only way we can win. And Hitler loves this crazy idea. But then they kind of, you know, scratch their heads. How can we actually make it happen? And at that time, the guy who had looked at methamphetamine, who was the professor for physiologist, he was the official army physiologist, Dr. Otto Ranke. He was responsible for trying to find ways to improve the fighting capability of the German soldier. And he had made these experiments with pervitin, and he had found that with pervitin, you can combat sleep. So he had suggested to the high command to provide the German army with methamphetamine on a regular official basis. And they actually, after they saw that in Poland in the attack, a lot of soldiers had used pervitin and they said it was good. Like they wrote reports back to this guy. Now they officially supplied, before the Western campaign started, all the medicinal officers with this pervitin, and Ranke wrote a so-called stimulant decree where he wrote, like, we are now taking pervitin. Basically, this is methamphetamine. We take two pills when the attack starts, and then the next two pills 6 hours later. And then if it's still needed, another two pills. So he described, like, the side effects, so the soldiers would know what they were taking. Like, so this was the first time in history that an army officially was supplied with very potent synthetic stimulant. So this is actually an interesting story. And it worked. You know, this was, they took the methamphetamine. They didn't have to sleep. Guderian, actually, the tank divisions had the most pervitin. I could see in the archive in Freiburg how the pervitin was distributed, like where it came from the Temmler company in Berlin. It was shipped to the front lines, and then it went through the Quartiermeister. Every division had a Quartiermeister, like a quartermaster or something like that, who would receive the pills and then distribute them to the Sanitätsoffiziere, the health officers. I don't know. Like, every unit has, like, some guy who's the doctor. He has the drugs. So he has the medicines. But so they all had now the pervitin. And it was, you can also see the numbers. And it's 35 million dosages. And it's not clear whether they mean they write units. So I don't know if it's a whole pervitin tube, which contains several pervitin pills, or whether 35 million means pills. But even 35 million pills is quite a lot for an army. I mean, they were, I think, 1.7 million. So it's a big army, but still. And the pervitin was not distributed. And I also could research that symmetrically. Not every soldier got the same amount. But the guys who were in the tanks, and this was the strategy for the first time in military history, the tanks were in front of the army. Like, they were the avant-garde. They were charging into enemy territory. Like, they used tanks, like crazy race cars, very dangerous, deadly, like things that just charged through France. And the French, like, they didn't believe what's going on there. Like, they saw these crazy German tanks coming that never stopped. They also rationed a drug, which they had done in the First World War already. And in the First World War, apparently it had helped them. And their drug of choice was red wine. Every French soldier received 3/4 of a liter of red wine every day. And they drank that red wine. So you can imagine, 3/4 of a liter alone, drink that alone, of heavy French wine, compared to like 3 pills of methamphetamine that a German soldier took. So that was totally asymmetrical fighting. You know, the French were still fighting like another First World War, while the Germans were fighting like already the Second World War. They were on a different level. So this to describe this campaign, I think it is relevant. It's not just, it didn't matter that they had amphetamines. It actually did matter. They were like the role model for other armies, because now obviously Western armies use stimulants.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in Vietnam, they basically
copied it from the Wehrmacht.
Yeah.
Like all the bad shit that the Nazis invented was basically then later copied and mutated. And now you have, American drone pilots, obviously on amphetamines when they go in there into that thing. Like I spoke to one, I had a Navy SEAL approach me in America. And he also said that when they have special missions, which last for like, let's say 16 hours, that of course we're not sober. I mean, we get every stimulant we want. So because you have to be, on that level for a long time in combat. So that Nazi idea to use stimulant drugs in combat to prolong fighting power and to reduce fear and all that, that was a genius idea in terms of, leading a war. That's why they were so successful in the beginning. The Blitzkrieg is... This guy was actually right, this historian, when he said there would be no Blitzkrieg without methamphetamine.
This podcast is also brought to you by Lucy Nicotine, a company that makes nicotine pouches, nicotine gum, and nicotine lozenges. I particularly enjoy the apple ice flavored nicotine pouch. It is a refreshing and well-formulated product. If you don't already use nicotine products, I recommend you don't begin. They're habit forming. But if you do, I think this is the finest nicotine product on the market. Thank you, Lucy. And in case this isn't already obvious, warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
So, but that's what, and the Nazi strategy was throughout the war was Blitzkrieg strategy, because they were always inferior. So the only chance they had was surprise the enemy and kind of take the enemy in a very short period of time. And that was the time window that Pavitin gave them. Like Guderian praised his troops for staying awake for 17 days and 17 nights, which sounds insane, but probably it's true because he said it. And I mean, you doze off once in a while, but that basically means they were awake for a very long time, like fighting nonstop. This is like a new type of fighting machine. And then then it didn't work against the Soviet Union because they were not able to take the Soviet Union in a blitzkrieg because it's too big. They were close to actually taking Moscow already in October, but then they didn't. And then the war dragged on, and then the Pavitin became useless because you can't sustain, a 3.5 year fighting period like the Soviet campaign was on methamphetamine. It's insane. The Soviets were just having their vodka, which is much better. It's also a hard drug, but it's not as hard as methamphetamine.
Wow. Yeah, that is really interesting. And because I don't speak German, I would not be able to access most of the historical literature on this, but I mean, I imagine that are there war memoirs that reflect this? I mean, if you have so many German soldiers that are taking this drug, you'd think there would be quite a bit of primary evidence in terms of letters home and people. Did you find anything like that in your research, people describing it and their own impressions of what it would have felt like to do this?
Well, there's the case of the famous German writer, at least in Germany, Heinrich Böll, who was he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in the 70s or 60s. And he's actually quite an interesting writer. And he was just a common soldier. But because he became such a known writer, his letters that he sent to his parents then at one point were published in Germany, and he writes about Pavitin quite a bit. But still, at that time, no one really noticed. So his letters were known before, but if you know about Pavitin, that it's methamphetamine and what it is, then these letters sound different to you than if you don't even actually know what Pavitin is. You just read his letters that he asked his parents to send him Pavitin because it gives him such a magic feeling when he has to stand on guard like the whole night and out under the stars. He says much better on Pavitin because you don't fall asleep and you feel good, and it's kind of because you have a psychedelic, not psychedelic, but you have a drug experience, so it's much better than not taking it. And then you probably have to drink a lot, or I don't know.
Right. It's almost like the Hermann Buhl thing that I was reading to you earlier, where there's almost an innocence to it. Like if now, if we're talking, we say Nazis on meth, it sounds terrible and insane. But then you read these descriptions of methamphetamine from that period without any of this cultural historical baggage, and they're saying, oh, you know, I took this pill, this Pervitin, and it was the most fantastic pill. It really had this effect on me where I had so much energy and I was able to do these things that I otherwise couldn't do. And it's really quite an amazing pill, this stuff. And if you didn't have all these associations, you'd just think, oh, that's nice. He had a nice little pick-me-up.
Yeah, this army physiologist, Professor Ranke, he wrote, like he asked like people who were fighting in Poland, I mean, the Germans who were fighting in Poland, to write back about Pervitin, and he received a lot of reports, and they're also all in the archive. You can read all of them, like where soldiers write, like it was so smooth to drive the tank this time, and it was like, and I could do it for like a day and a whole, and the night, and then the next day. And a lot of them actually write that the workload was easier, you know, and the workload was invading a foreign country and killing people. I mean, we have to keep in mind that the German army in the war against Poland and then also in the Western campaign was different from the German army after the attack on the Soviet Union. That's when the crimes against humanity happened. Before that, the German army was not a Nazi army. It was the German, the army of Germany. And obviously the people who controlled them were all Nazis, but the army itself had like its own ethos. And so for them, Pervitin was also, because they were kind of rational thinking Prussian organization. So they just concluded with Pervitin, we can fight longer. That's an advantage. The fear level is reduced. That's an advantage. People feel good, because you don't really feel good if you go to war. You need, you know, hardcore indoctrination. No one likes to go. I mean, maybe some people, but it's not natural to go to war and fight, like invade another country. Like it's much better to set these people under some kind of drug that increases their mood and lets them feel good and makes them energetic. So I think this attack against Poland and the Western campaign, these were like the glorious days of the best army that ever existed. Like they were just winning and feeling great. And, you know, and this was like, and they were extremely successful. I mean, it's crazy. This one country invading like the whole of Europe, basically, until they started going against the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing. It is amazing. And I feel there's this kind of overarching tension with these sorts of things, because obviously drugs have enormous effects on human behavior and psychology. And what you're describing makes perfect sense to me. Like, you give people that are non-tolerant high doses of methamphetamine, of course, they can go for days without sleep. They can go for days without food. They could probably do things that would otherwise be impossible. And that all makes perfect sense. But then there's this kind of, you know, this concept, pharmacological determinism, where you start to think that drugs do a certain thing, and you take it a step further and you say, oh, and that's how they were able to be so evil, because this is somehow an intrinsic property of methamphetamine, is that it gives you this diabolical power to do evil. You know, this is like, I don't know if you're familiar with the case of Jeffrey McDonald. Do you know about this?
Was he on meth and did evil things?
So he was this kind of perfect man, this, you know, very handsome football player, athlete, surgeon, went to Princeton, had a perfect family, beautiful children, green beret, everything you could want an American to be, Jeffrey McDonald was. And in 1969, shortly after the Manson murders, he claims that a group of hippies came into his apartment chanting, acid is groovy, kill the pigs, acid is groovy, kill the pigs, and slaughtered his entire family, his pregnant wife, his two daughters.
That's what he says.
Yeah. So this is very suspicious and nobody knows exactly what happened to this day. Jeffrey McDonald's still alive. He's serving a life sentence for murdering his entire family. He was, and it's a very interesting story that is
the
just...
The judge didn't believe him.
Well, it's a long story. I won't get into all of the twists and turns of it. But yes, eventually he was convicted, but there was a problem, which was that he never had a motive. Why would this perfect man, this physician whose life is dedicated to healing, kill so brutally his entire family, bludgeon his daughter, stab his daughter with an ice pick, all of this? And there was no motive. But then they had to find a motive to explain this terrible crime. And the best they could do was say, well, you know, we did find out he was taking an amphetamine type diet pill around the time of these murders. And that explains it. There you go. That's how this man killed his whole family. And drugs have always served that role in our culture. And that's one of the things that's made me uncomfortable with these arguments, is I simultaneously acknowledge the validity of what you're describing, and it seems totally possible, but I also know how that same sort of thinking has been dramatically misused, and, you know, ranging from the most innocuous, like, oh, I just did it because I was drunk. It wasn't me. I was just so drunk that I did this thing that was totally uncharacteristic. And it's simultaneously plausible, but there's something kind of missing in it, because of course, while people do things that they otherwise wouldn't do while they were drunk, you can't use being drunk as an excuse for any sort of crime. And that's been my kind of overarching conflict with these ideas. And I think it's really important to do what you've done and examine all of this, because there is no simple answer to it. It's neither like a perfect explanation, nor is it without explanatory value.
This podcast is also brought to you by matcha.com. Grab a traditional matcha bowl or your favorite mug and enjoy a hot cup of matcha first thing in the morning. I don't drink coffee, but I think matcha is a wonderful way to start the day. It contains L-theanine, it contains caffeine, which is what I'm most interested in, and it has all sorts of purported health benefits. Matcha.com was founded by psychedelic pioneer Dr. Andrew Weil. All of their matcha is imported from Japan and third-party tested for heavy metals. It's delicious, probably healthy, and certainly stimulating. So enjoy a cup of matcha from matcha.com.
Well, I spoke with my father about this, who was a judge before his retirement, and he actually said that if you commit a crime under the influence of drugs, it does not diminish your responsibility. That's actually what the law says. I mean, the book also, you know, when you read it, because of the way it's written, I think, and the tone, you kind of understand how I stand in this question. Because obviously that is a danger that a book like this might like excuse the Nazis, or some people might think it might excuse the Nazis from, you know, their crimes because they were just high on drugs. Because in a way, if you are on methamphetamine, you might even commit, you know, you act differently in battle, I guess. So maybe some things you would do, but the Nazis' crimes, they come out of their Nazi ideology, their racist ideology. And there's no connection with that ideology with drugs. Like, it was not that like Hitler was on drugs and then he wrote Mein Kampf. Like, the whole Nazi ideology has nothing really to do with drugs. I mean, a lot of them were using a lot of alcohol when the Nazis for the first time kind of showed their heads above ground in 1923 in the so-called beer hall putsch. They actually came from the fucking beer hall. They came from the beer hall. They were all drunk, except Hitler, who never drank, apparently. I kind of do make it clear in my book that my description doesn't excuse the crimes, because I really don't feel that's the case. And I think it would be a wrong... I think when you read the book, you don't have this feeling.
Yeah. And I'm not accusing you of doing that, by the way. This is a very common tendency in...
That's why it was criticized by one stupid British historian who was like saying that the book was so successful in Germany because it excuses the crimes of the Wehrmacht, which is totally not true. I mean, that's not why the book is successful in Germany. It's just not true. But
Nor would it excuse any crime, even if it. Yeah, that's an absurd. I mean, the only city, like, there was this book that I've never been able to find anywhere else. It was just, there's one copy of it in the library at UChicago called Illusionogenic Drugs and Criminal Responsibility. It's also the only time I've seen the word illusionogenic used in anything. And it's a analysis of this question that sort of concludes, you know, with these examples. The book opens with this very bizarre vignette of somebody who takes LSD and thinks that they are trapped in a gigantic canister of hair cream, and they're trying to climb out of the canister of hair cream, but in reality, they're actually stabbing somebody to death. And as I recall, I haven't read this since maybe 2007 or something, but, you know, that would be some kind of hypothetical example. If your perception of reality were so fundamentally distorted that you no longer knew right from wrong and were no longer conceptualizing anything with any semblance of connection to the real world. But obviously methamphetamine doesn't tend to do that. But this was, you know, a very important thing in illuminating this aspect of World War II that is really not discussed. I mean, even on the American side as well. Like, there's this YouTube channel where this guy takes MREs, like military rations, and goes through them all. And occasionally he'll be going through, you know, some American ration, and he'll pull out a strip of amphetamine tablets, and I'll say, okay, like, that's not what we're reviewing today. And I think, like, wow, you know, this is just a part of all of this. It doesn't get discussed. And clearly it is part of what allows people to, yeah, even just go without sleep. And so I started reading Blitzed because I was really interested in psychedelic experiments that the Nazis had done, which is another thing that is almost never discussed, which is amazing to me because people are so interested in MKUltra. They're so interested in the idea, maybe more broadly, that the American counterculture was somehow some kind of government plot that was facilitated through drug use. And so you started looking into all of that, and we started talking about this yesterday, but then got sort of cut off. But I'm curious about what you found. Did I bum you out with?
Well, I don't want to repeat what we already said yesterday. Or do you think it should be repeated in different words? Or can you ask more specifically what I found out?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also, do you feel like I made it sound like you were making some kind of exculpatory claim for the Nazis? Because that's not what I was suggesting.
No.
Okay. So where we left off yesterday, you were starting to talk about how a story that I'd never heard at all, how someone that was working with Hoffman had some kind of Nazi connection, and this could have impacted the commercialization of LSD.
I mean, it was not someone who was working with Hoffman. It was Arthur Stoll, who was the head.
But there was another.
No, it was Arthur Stoll.
Arthur Stoll.
Yeah, Arthur Stoll. Arthur Stoll was the protege of Richard Wildstätter, who was the Jewish-German main chemist of the early 20th century. He received the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, I don't know, sometime in the 20s, early 20s, for chlorophyll, like working on chlorophyll. So he was, Wildstätter was, he's like a forefather of biochemistry. So his best student was Arthur Stoll. And in 1970, the Sando Color Company, they just made colors, Sando in Basel, they wanted to reinvest, especially after the First World War. They made a lot of money with colors because, you know, a lot of things had to be restored and painted. So making color was good business after the First World War. So Sando's invested money in a pharmaceutical branch, and they selected Arthur Stoll, the protege of Richard Wildstätter, to kind of lead the pharmaceutical branch of Sandoz. And then Arthur Stoll had the idea to examine the so-called ergot, And the ergot was a very potent plant. Mushroom that other companies had also tried to utilize, but no one had managed. Like Wellcome, the American pharmaceutical company, they issued a statement, ergot, which just can't get our heads around it or something like that. But then Altristor was able to isolate the potent alkaloids of ergot. And he developed several medicines out of these alkaloids, which made the first, you know, big wins for Sandoz pharmaceutical branch. And then at one point he employed more chemists because, you know, he couldn't do it all himself, and he employed Albert Hofmann. He became his chief chemist. And then Albert Hofmann basically continued this ergot research. First, Stoll didn't really want him to do that because he was like, he thought ergot belongs to him, but Hofmann really had some ideas that he could do some amazing things with ergot. And then kind of Stoll allowed him to, and then Hofmann quickly created an ergot-based medicine. I think it's Hydergin. I think Stoll's was Gynergen. And they're basically used right after birth to stop the bleeding and stop contractions and whatever. You know, I think it's a medicine. The one that Hofmann then developed immediately canceled out the one that Stoll had invented, because Hofmann's was much better. And I think the Hofmann, the Hydergen.
Hofmann was Hydergen, but that's
okay. Hydergen in Deutsch, in German.
Yeah.
Hydergen's from Hofmann. I think that's still like a bestseller.
Yeah.
So
have you taken it?
No.
Yeah.
I have not taken any Sandoz product, actually, except the illegal ones. I take very little pharmaceuticals. I really don't like, I don't trust the companies at all. I really don't. I'm rather sober and take shit from pharmaceutical companies.
And you went through Hofmann's lab notebooks, right?
Well, you have to, because if you go to the Novartis archive in order to research something, it's very unlike an official archive where you are presented with the find book, which explains to you it explains like where's the stuff is in the archives, like what they have and what categories they organize in, what years, and like different department. Like a find book basically is a very complex thing that enables you to find something in the archives. And at Novartis, they don't have a find book. So I said to the archivist, so how can I find something? I have no idea what you have if you don't show it to me. And he said, well, you have to basically ask me and then I look, you know. And so you kind of become dependent on him, the archivist. So it's a very toxic relationship, because you're just dependent on him, and he can do whatever he wants, you know. But then again, it's a company archive. I mean, every company has the right to do whatever they want with their archives. It's kind of unusual that a pharmaceutical giant like Novartis actually has an open archive. Anyone can go there. So they don't need to show me anything, I think, you know. I mean, it's not an official archive. So they do show you things, and the archivist is very happy to present the original lab books by Albert Hofmann, which are, of course, very impressive, you know, because they are the original lab books by Albert Hofmann.
If you're looking for a kratom product, allow me to recommend Top Tree Herbs and Nubru Kratom Kava Green Tea Seltzer. Both are third-party tested. These are pure products that I can personally recommend. Nubru is a delicious carbonated Kratom Kava green tea seltzer. And if you're looking for a nice, a simple, tasty Kratom tea, go for Top Tree Herbs. This is your health. You should get something that's tested. You can get 15% off using the promo code Hamilton. Thank you, Top Tree Herbs and Nubru, for your sponsorship.
Did you digitize them?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I took some photos.
Yeah.
Yeah, I took some photos, even though it's not allowed, but he doesn't look.
Aha. Did you look at the page with the original LSD synthesis on it?
Yeah, I looked at these pages.
Do you have a photo of it?
I don't know. I took a lot of photos. And so we can look on my phone.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, you probably see much more, you know, than me, like, because you're a chemist, you know, I was like more interested in, you know, what he writes down, how he feels and how his handwriting changes. But I like the chemical knowledge to really, like, for example, understand, like, on April 16th, like, he was handling, and then he had a trip, like, what do you think, how did it get into his system? Through the eyes, through the hands, breathing it in, or you don't know.
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, people didn't wear gloves then, but he would have been aware of the potency of the compounds even without predicting.
Yeah, I think that's a bit strange. Like, there's something fishy about that already. Like, how? Or you think it's just a straight story?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's worth going over the fishiness because there's a couple slightly unusual things. So you have, so 1943, or the first synthesis, what? 38.
Yeah.
So then
it's, the mice, the chapter in my book is called The Mice Don't Feel Anything, because they don't.
Yeah.
That's why the chapter's LSD is basically closed at Sundance, because it was not so interesting.
So you make this stuff, it's not so interesting, then
nothing happens, basically.
Then for reasons that are not well understood, he decides to reinvestigate, has this premonition, is exposed to it somehow. People debate this endlessly. David E. Nichols thinks it was a spontaneous mystical experience. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't understand exactly why he thinks that, but he does. Then does the self-experiment in 43, and people find it a little weird because there's, you know, military interest in psychedelics, especially, or ... So you have these two German patents in the interwar period, one for the amphetamine variant of mescaline and one for escaline. And what they're being used for is not clear to me. Maybe you would, as a German speaker, be able to pick out some subtle aspect of this.
Well, I mean, the largest experiments with psychedelic substances were made in the concentration camp of Dachau. And there's some reports that are accessible, and they talk about mescaline and another, and some other substance. And I think you read that at one point they also write about a special substance.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible that there was another substance, but there's no record that anyone has ever found, like, what substance exactly it was. So it could have been those two, you know, substances that you just mentioned, where Germany had the patents. Or, of course, it could have been LSD, because I also found in the Novartis archives and also in other archives in Zurich, for example, at ETH University, that there was a close connection between Stoll, who was this boss of Hoffmann and the founder of the pharmaceutical branch of Sandoz, Stoll, Arthur Stoll. He was closely collaborating with Richard Kuhn, who also had been a protege of Wildstätter. And Richard Kuhn was not a Jew, but he was actually a Nazi. At least he worked as Hitler's leading biochemist within the Nazi system, and invented sarin, which is the deadliest nerve poison for Hitler's war machine. And Stoll and Kuhn were exchanging information very freely in both directions. They had visited each other's labs countless times, also before the war, also in the 20s. So they were really, like, Kuhn knew everything about the ergot research that Sandoz did, and they would exchange, you know, the information. Obviously, Stoll would have told Kuhn also about LSD, because LSD was such a big thing when they were, you know, discussing things. What is it? What could it be? What do we do with it? And Kuhn at the same time was responsible for, not responsible for, but involved in this search for the so-called truth drug, which was an obsession by the Nazis to find that substance that can let you read the mind of the other person, because the Nazis being obsessed with the other as the, you know, the big danger. So either you're with us or you're our enemy. So an instrument to read like the minds of the people and control the minds was, you know, was their wet dream. So they thought that maybe mescaline is that drug. That's why they used it in Dachau to test new interrogation methods, etc. So it's not implausible that Richard Kuhn, when he heard from Stoll about LSD and that he became interested in it. And I found one letter where Kuhn actually acknowledges receiving half a gram of ergotamine, which is a, how do you say, precursor?
Yeah.
A precursor to LSD. So I think it's possible that LSD was used in Dachau, but again, there's no final proof for this. It could also have been other substances. But I think one thing is clear, that because Kuhn knew about LSD and was involved in this truth drug search of the Nazis, that's why that he talked about this when Germany was invaded by American troops. He was in Heidelberg, and Heidelberg was taken by American troops. And the American troops had a special unit called Alsos, and the Alsos men were responsible to retrieve information regarding the nuclear program of the Nazis, because Americans were afraid that actually the Nazis were quite far in developing the nuclear bomb, like more advanced than they were. So they made this unit called Alsos, and Alsos unit was also responsible for finding information on biological warfare / also truth drugs. That was like a side mission that they had. And they discussed with Richard Kuhn in Heidelberg. They had their regional headquarters in Heidelberg, Alsos. And Kuhn was one of their main informers. So they knew about the truth drug and LSD. And their report makes it into the American military intelligence, or people who are thinking about also a truth drug and biological warfare and controlling people's minds. I mean, this was the beginning of the Cold War, so this was a hot, very hot topic. So they become very interested in LSD, and General Clay, that was his name, but it's a different Clay, like some General Clay. No, it wasn't Clay. I have to look it up in the book, but some general flies from the US then to Heidelberg, also talks with Kuhn, gets briefed again about LSD and the truth drug, finds it highly interesting, takes the train to Switzerland and receives samples of LSD from Sandoz company. And all this, I mean, all this is, you know, documented. So all this is like, you can find out in the archives. And then actually LSD in a way is lost, you know, because now it's in the claws of the American military apparatus, and then from there goes to the first centralized intelligence agency that the United States had, which was CIA, because before they basically were terrible in intelligence. So then the CIA was formed and they became, you know, the best. So, and there it was used in the, you know, famous program MK Ultra, with all these like hundreds of different research programs in different universities. Like the universities were abused by the CIA because they got funding from some foundation like the Geschichte Fund for whatever research, and this was actually just a front organization that the CIA paid. So that's how they made all these, basically used research in universities for their own kind of research on LSD, just to control LSD and turn it into a very effective weapon.
Right. And I feel like you could even take it a step further and not just say that MKUltra used these substances, but that MKUltra was created as a direct ramification of Nazi psychedelic research. Isn't that kind of the chain?
Yeah, right.
Where you have Beecher, you have American intelligence that are sent to interrogate Nazi scientists after the war and to collect whatever information, often on interrogation. So they're doing this sort of like interrogation about interrogation, and they learn about Nazi use of mescaline. There's also in one of these papers, there's a passing reference to N-ethyl LSA, like monoethyl instead of diethyl.
I don't know what that means.
It's like just an LSD derivative that they just in one passing mention say has even more psychosis inducing. But I find it interesting because if they're sending ergotamine instead of just sending LSD, then
why would they do that actually?
Well, the only reason I could imagine would be if they wanted to make something other than LSD, or there was the idea, because if you send LSD, there's not all that much you can make from it. I mean, you can, but...
From LSD.
But if you send ergotamine, you have more flexibility in terms of making different compounds.
Well, maybe Kuhn said, yeah, I want to try this ergotamine. I want to see what I can do with it. Maybe I have some ideas, something like that.
He's a chemist.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Nobel Prize chemist.
Yes. Yeah.
And he's a good chemist. So maybe, I mean, maybe, you know, it's also possible that Stoltz sent him LSD and there's no paper trail. Because, or maybe LSD wasn't even so much in Stoltz's head already. Because Hoffman had this first trip and then, like, he took it again. He took it again. This was in April, and he took it again, I think, a couple of times over the summer, but maybe not so much immediately happened with LSD. I mean, he was recruited by the Swiss Army, and he was working, well, working. He was like, he was on duty in the fall of 43, and then he started actually to experiment with microdosing. He wanted to see the lowest dose, and that's what I read in his books, was searching for the lowest dose where he just feels something. But yeah, I mean, the microdose basically. And he found it. Well, he said it was 20 micrograms. Well, he used 20, and then he was still, you know, being able to do the military things that they did. I mean, they were just in Switzerland, so they were not fighting, but they had to do some drills and stuff like that because Switzerland wanted to be ready when the Germans come. But the Germans never came.
And as you were going through these archives, were you just operating from a position of pure curiosity about finding things that other historians had missed? Or was there something that you were hoping to demonstrate, something that you were looking to prove?
Well, this has to do actually with my mother, who suffers from Alzheimer, and my father and me had the idea to discuss with her that maybe microdosages of LSD could be good against Alzheimer's, because I had read like in one paper that it might be good. So my father said, you have to kind of, what is this LSD? Is it really so, why is it not in medicine if it's so good? I don't believe this, because he had been a judge. So he had even sent people to jail for drugs. It's not as bad in Germany as it is in the United States, but you know, it's basically the same laws, you know, anti-drug laws, not as severe punishments, but kind of similar. So for him, it was kind of a big step to use an illegal substance with his, you know, wife so many years. So he wanted me to kind of research. I mean, I knew, you know, what LSD is kind of, but I really then took it to heart to kind of really research what is LSD and why actually didn't it end up in the pharmacies? Why did it end up on the black market? And in German, we say Schmuddelecke, like a dark corner of the universe where like strange LSD. I mean, it had a very bad reputation at times, you know, how did this actually happen? And the common belief is that this is all because of the 60s when they quote-unquote exaggerated it. I mean, I was just interested in what had happened before, like the early history of LSD. And that is, you know, I think is the history of Arthur Stoll, is his connection with Richard Kuhn, is the Americans invading liberating Germany and taking the files and taking the knowledge and developing their own truth drug program. And then putting pressure on Sandoz, on Arthur Stoll, not to proceed with the legalization, with, you know, putting it onto the market, because Sandoz always wanted to put it on the market. They thought they had like a big hit with LSD, because they did the first tests that were actually done with LSD were inside the Sandoz company when they created the Rauschraum, the inebriation room, where people worked at Sandoz could try LSD, and they all had completely favorable comments to make. Like, no one disliked it. Everyone thought it was great.
Are there photos of this Rauschraum?
I didn't find any. I looked, you know, but I only saw the, you know, the written statements.
And this in and of itself is kind of an unusual way to go about demonstrating to your parents that LSD is a medically useful substance, going through the darkest chapter of its history and investigating the possibility that it was used by the Nazis. Was that somehow encouraging for your parents?
That's history in Germany. You always get back to the stupid Nazis. But I mean, my father, he was born in 43, so he's actually born while Hitler was still Chancellor of Germany. So it's a very German story in a way, this family story, because it does go back to the Nazis. But since it does go back to the Nazis, I think it makes sense, and my father can relate to it. But I don't know if that, you know, makes him more eager to, you know, give LSD. You know, that wouldn't make a lot of sense. But I think LSD is just such an interesting substance that it's also interesting to know its history. I just found it highly interesting. And I think you should know some things about LSD before you take it. I mean, if you don't know, the first time I took LSD, I didn't know what it was. I really did not know anything, like nothing. I had no information on it. And I was like 23, so that's quite old, you know. But that was also in 1993, so those were different times. There was no internet yet. So I didn't know anything, and it was a very strong dose that I received. So I think it's good for my father to understand the history of LSD, because he's also a history interest. He's interested in history, like in stories, like where do things come from. And he also writes historical novels himself, and so it was an interesting story for him. And I think it created also a bond between us, like a narrative bond. And so the disease of my mother actually created a lot of it was created also because of this disease. It was also degenerative. It also things, you know, happened that were good in the family.
Yeah.
And LSD actually played in a vital part. So it's kind of funny that LSD would, you know, play like a positive role in our family, but it did.
Yeah.
Kind of therapeutic in a way.
And you think that it's helped your mother?
Well, I saw it with my own eyes. I've seen it several times, that when she is on microdosages, that she feels better. She's just more fun to be around, because one aspect of the Alzheimer's disease is that you become apathic. You just sit there and you have no more interest in the outside world because you don't understand it anymore. So you just kind of withdraw, and the drop of LSD or of psilocybin, it's also just has similar effect, kind of wakes her up. Her cheeks are redder. She looks around, she laughs, she talks more, she talks longer sentences. On Mother's Day, she picked up the newspaper on the table and started reading it to us, which she hadn't done before in a very long time. She was on psilocybin drops on Mother's Day for the first time. So we, you know, scientists would say this is anecdotal, obviously, but we enjoy these anecdotes. And she enjoys them too. So it's good. It's work. I would say it's working. As a non-physician, I would say it's working.
And for people that want to read your book, it hasn't been published in the United States yet, but when can they buy a copy, and how will they find it, and how can they find your other work?
HarperCollins is publishing it in the US in March or April. I actually have to ask them this week because I want to know now too, because it's coming up. The America always takes much longer to publish a book, which I think is totally strange. Like the translation is already done, the cover is already done, but it still takes so long because I think the marketing, I don't know, it's like the apparatus is bigger in America. So in Germany, it's already out now. In France, it's coming out end of the month. But in the Czech Republic, where we are right now, I think it also will take another couple of months because they still need to translate it. Because I don't even know if they translate from the German. They should. They should also be done by now. And Italy is coming out soon. But America takes the longest. But maybe they're going to do the best job, you know, because they prepared and, you know, they make a plan how they bring it out. And so they're quite professional also.
Yeah.
They're like, they really take capitalism very seriously and try to sell as many books as possible and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I find all of this so fascinating because it's maybe like a different shade of the deterministic argument where now there's a compensatory backlash against psychedelics. So everyone is talking about how psychedelics are, you know, a treatment for PTSD and depression and eating disorders and you name it. This represents the next psychiatric frontier. And whenever something becomes popular, then the pendulum of novelty is forced to swing in the opposite direction journalistically. It's inevitable. It always happens. And as soon as people started exclusively writing positive things about psychedelics, it almost filled me with a certain dread because I knew that for every drop of enthusiasm, it was inevitable that there would be some price to pay for it. And so it's become increasingly fashionable in the United States to have these various negative takes on psychedelics that are often a war of different deterministic arguments about psychedelics. So you have the conventional liberal perspective, which is these are drugs that make you ecologically conscious and you want to embrace your brother man and save the world and become a vegetarian and understand the value of love. And people say, oh, are you kidding me? These were used in Dachau. These were used during MK Ultra. This is military technology that is used to control and interrogate. These drugs are inextricably linked to the atrocities that were being done during their early development. And this is somehow a stain that the molecules must carry. And I find both sides ridiculous. I find the idea that these will inevitably make people good or bad are two sides of the same meaningless deterministic coin. But at the same time, I find it all fascinating and I think it's extremely valuable. Have you learned anything? I mean, what you describe with methamphetamine is very persuasive. Like you make a very persuasive case that this had an impact during World War II. Do you feel the same way about psychedelics?
Well, I don't know if you know the DJ Ricardo Villalobos. He's this underground DJ god, and he's also happens to be a friend of mine, and he told me when I told him I'm gonna write about LSD that there's nothing to tell. Actually, it's not a story, it doesn't matter, it's not important. But somehow I think it is, because it's always said drugs are neutral, right? So like, but I don't think really methamphetamine is neutral. I think it's toxic actually. And so I would say it's in a way a neg. I mean, you might think totally different, right?
I do, yeah.
Maybe it's not toxic. Maybe I'm just brainwashed. And so you wouldn't say methamphetamine is like LSD is better than methamphetamine. You wouldn't say that.
Right? No.
It just.
I think they're different. I mean, it's like saying. You know, is a cucumber better than a Snickers bar? Nutritionally, yes, it is better, but they're just different.
Well, okay, things. Ricardo Villalobos thought there's no reason to write this book. I mean, my mother did get, you know, better when she was taking LSD, and she still takes it, and then she feels better. So I think that's a reason actually to write this. But that's just for me, you know. I think in general, well, I look in my book also at the war on drugs, where it actually comes from, and we all know it comes from Harry J. Anslinger. But I actually went to his archives in Penn State, his archives, like his estate, Penn State University. And it's kind of interesting to see this pulp fictional racist police magazine, true crime magazine world that he lived in. And then I followed his narcotic, whose name was Arthur Giuliani, and he came into Berlin after the Second World War, like in late 45. And his job was to, and Anslinger gave him the job to form like a unified anti-drug regime in the whole of Berlin. Berlin was occupied by four forces: the Soviet Union, United States, Great Britain, and France. So Giuliani was supposed to unite all the other sectors, like all the other, like every sector had a drug kind of official. And he was the one for the American zone, and to convince all the others to agree to Anslinger's prohibitionist policies, which were actually very much influenced by the prohibitionist policies of the Nazis. Anslinger actually spoke fluent German. He knew exactly, you know, the Rauschgiftbekämpfung that the Nazis did. In a way, the Nazis were the first really radical anti-drug regime at all. So Anslinger was heavily influenced by the German, you know, anti-drug law, and then sent Giuliani there to implement that, because his goal, because then he was also in the United Nations. Anslinger was like the American representative, so he basically designed the global anti-drug policies, and that originated also in this occupied Berlin right after the war. So I'm kind of examining these things. I think they do play a role, but I mean, they are a little bit more complex than Hitler shooting OxyContin and deciding to have a second Ardennes offensive. So it's a different book. And I don't think LSD was so important. Well, I mean, the war on drugs totally shaped our society, so it is very important.
It's extremely important.
And yeah, to see where it comes from, yeah. So,
and what about these weird leads? Because there's something maddening about going through MKUltra-related literature. And
it's horribly boring, actually.
Okay. And when you find something interesting, it leads to a dead end. Like, I don't know how much time you spent on the... I may be mispronouncing this. What is it? Pont Saint-Esprit? Is that how you pronounce it?
What?
What is the town in France? Is it Pont Saint-Esprit?
Yeah.
Is that how it's pronounced?
I think Pont de Saint-Esprit. Oui.
Yeah. Did you get into that?
Yeah. Yeah. But only to a certain point. Because then you reach a point and it gets even further and further, and it becomes... I don't know what actually happened there. Maybe you know, but I find the information a bit... You just don't know exactly what happened somehow.
I don't think anybody does. And you have to deal with all these...
But Hoffman went there. I thought that was crazy.
It is crazy.
He actually went on the ground to check it out.
And everyone has their little weird documents. I actually did to you one of my least favorite things. I have a term for this, which is being a dangler. When somebody says, like, oh, I have some information you might find interesting... And then they tease you with the information, but they never provide it. I was doing that to you, so I apologize for doing that. It's very annoying.
You were dangling.
I was dangling. I try. Okay. I'm not normally that way. But I was in the same boat of just trying to collect all this information, trying to form some kind of a cohesive case. And it's slippery. It's really hard to figure out what was going on and to organize it and to make any sort of coherent picture of what Nazi psychedelic experimentation looked like and what was truly being done during this early MKUltra era. And
it's hard because so many documents have been destroyed.
Yeah.
So we never, that's why it's a bit frustrating to tell that story, because you can't really tell it.
Yeah.
Because you don't know. Also, they apparently had these rooms where they drugged people and then they filmed them and on LSD, like, where are these films and where's this stuff? And I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
it's not so easy.
Yeah.
To tell the story. It's easier to tell the story before, I think, like before MK Ultra. That's what I think is more interesting, because there has not been a book about this, like, early. It usually starts with MK Ultra. So I thought it was more interesting.
I look forward to reading it.
Yeah.
Any final things you think people should know?
Well, that I wanted to call the book LSD for Mom. I'm not tripped.
Call it that. You should do that. Insist. Is it too late?
Well, I mean, that the American, you know, publisher has already, like, sent, like, the finished cover to all, like, Amazon, like, everywhere, you know. It's I don't know, I think it's a bit fucked up. It would have been better like 6 months ago. I have to think about it.
You should insist. This happened to my dad with he made this film that I think is one of his best films, called Mr. Death, that nobody ever talks about because it has a bad name. It's and his name for it was Honeymoon in Auschwitz, but they said, oh, you can't call it Honeymoon in Auschwitz, it has to be Mr. Death. And so he relented, he allowed it to be called Mr. Death, and the result is that it is a movie that just doesn't get talked about half as much as it should be.
I haven't seen it.
It's really good. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you for talking, having me on your show.